Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Thursday. Thursday, February 7th, 2013. I'm Sam Minter. Yvonne Bo is not with us today. We had one of those scheduling things this week. We normally record on Monday UTC, which is Sunday night in the U.S., and there was some sort of event going on where people throw something around and run around, and I guess in the middle they turn the lights out? I don't know. Anyway, Yvonne was watching that. I was not. And so we didn't do it that night. And then the next night didn't work for him for some reason. And the night after that wouldn't work for me. And then whatever. Anyway, we were going to do it tonight, which is Wednesday night in the U.S., Thursday UTC, early Thursday UTC. But then, you know, he couldn't get his baby to sleep. And so he's like, yeah, let's not put it off any further and go ahead and do a solo show. So I'm doing a solo show this week. First time in a long time. It's been a while. And, you know, I don't have a set agenda because I hadn't planned on doing a solo show. Now, I have a sort of a scratch list that I put together of, you know, stuff that might be something to talk about. There's the big iPhone rumors. There's Obama's cyber warfare policies that came out. There's Obama's putting out a document leaked, and now he's going to put it out, something about basically the rules on drone attacks. The post office has announced it's going to only 5 days delivery for most things. There's the whole gun control thing that's going on. There's the sequester. I mentioned that sporty thing. There's the Boy Scouts thinking about letting in gay scouts. But keep in mind, he's still not atheists or agnostics, but maybe the gays. Anyway, there's the whole thing with Dell going private. There's the Surface Pro coming out. And then there's things that have been going on for a while, like, you know, the whole Disney now owning Star Wars and blah, blah, blah. I don't know. I don't know if I'll go through that list. I will mention one other sort of personal thing before I go any further. I realize that it's now the beginning of February, which means, and I don't know if I've mentioned this on the show before, but means it has now been approximately, I don't know exactly the day I started, but I know it was in the beginning of February-ish. It's been approximately a year since I've drunk a caffeinated beverage. And, you know, look, I don't have any, like, immediate thing about caffeine. It's not a religious thing. It's not like whatever. But, you know, I was cutting out the big sugary drinks from, you know, coffee shops. And because, frankly, I was drinking way too many of them, just huge calorie bombs that I just did not need. And and so I cut those out. But then I found myself substituting. I was like, okay, I'm not drinking the big, you know, white chocolate mochas every day, like one or two a day, which had been my pattern. But then I found myself drinking soda instead. Well, that didn't really help. That's still big calorie bombs I didn't need. And for that matter, forget the calories. It's just sugar I don't need. And so I did a couple of things. One was just, you know, I don't need this caffeine stuff anyway. It's like, I get, you know, you get this withdrawal cycle, you get this dependency cycle where you're on the caffeine, you're taking it all the time, and then you go without it for a little while, and, you know, you start getting the headaches, and you whatever, and I'm like, I don't need that. I don't need to be dependent on some chemical, even if it's just caffeine. You know, I can, if I'm too sleepy, then the right answer is get more sleep. It's not like down caffeine to try to keep awake and keep active and blah, blah, blah. So I'm like, you know, whatever. And it was one of these things where I didn't intentionally stop. I just sort of didn't do it for one day. And then I didn't do it for 2 days. And then I didn't do it for 3 days. And then about a week in, I'm like, hey, I've gone without caffeine for about a week. I can keep going. And so now it's been about a year. Now, I want to make some caveats there. It's without intentionally drinking a caffeinated beverage. Okay, because I mean, caffeine is another thing. I've had chocolate. Chocolate has caffeine, you know. Whatever, you know. But it's the caffeinated beverages. It's the Cokes. It's the whatever. You know, I think maybe once in the first few weeks I slipped and accidentally had some tea without realizing. Oh my God, that's got caffeine too. But you know, that was like in the first week or something. So it's still like early February where this started. And I've also, because I realized, you know, substituting this, you know, okay, get rid of the caffeinated colas, get rid of the coffee, get rid of all that stuff. If I just start drinking, you know, soda or whatever, other kinds of non-caffeinated sodas, that's not, I'm still getting the big sugar bombs and whatever. So I also started, this has been almost that whole year. I think I started a couple months later of this part. Only one non-water drink per day. So, and it's usually like 9 times out of 10, it's orange juice. Every once in a while, I'll go for like a Sprite or whatever. But, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's orange juice. Mostly water. And, you know, I found, you know, I'm not really missing this stuff that much. I'll also say this went along with, like, from April until October, I was also just generally being good and doing smaller portions and exercising more. And, you know, I lost a bunch of pounds, which is good because I need to do that. But then come around, you know, starting in the end of September, I've had like one thing or another where I was sick, I wasn't feeling good, whatever. And so, you know, I'm still doing the drink stuff, but like the exercise went to hell. The eating right went to hell. The eating small portions went to hell. And I was like, you know, I feel like crap. I'm going to eat a damn cookie or whatever, or potato chips, or I'm going to have a second serving of whatever. Cause you know, I didn't feel good. And I was like, whatever. I'm trying to get back on that wagon now. Cause I'm feeling a little bit better now, but you know, anyway, the whole point of this was just, hey, I've been a year without caffeinated beverages. That's pretty cool. And I would actually like, I'd recommend it. You don't really need that caffeine. You may think you need it, but you don't really need it. And, you know, yes, there's a withdrawal period. Like the first couple weeks probably suck a bit, but once you get past that, you're fine. You know, so you don't need this stuff. Come on. Yeah. You don't need to feed the coffee industry. You don't need to feed the soda industry. It's really, you know, yes, it's enjoyable. And, you know, and frankly, I have this, I stopped at cold turkey because I'm really bad at doing things in moderation. I'm pretty decent at just saying, I'm not going to do that anymore, and just stopping completely. But then if I miss once and, you know, I go and get a coffee or I go and get a Coke, I'm done. All of a sudden I'll be doing it a lot again. So for me, most things are all or nothing. I'm really not good with the moderation thing. Although I know that's probably the best way to do it. Whatever, you know. Anyway, it worked for me, sort of. So I don't know. We'll have real things to talk about. I've babbled long enough about this and nobody cares but me. And I know that and I apologize. We'll be back after this short break with something else. I don't know what yet. And I think instead of going down that list of stuff that I listed, I'm just going to open up my Google Reader and scroll down through some articles until I find one that I want to talk about. And we'll go from there. We'll be back after this.
This is a break. Oh, yes, this is a break. This is a break because no one gave me any suggestions. I told you. I warned you. So this is a break. This is a wonderful break. A wonderful break. Yes, indeed, this is a break. This is a break in the middle of Curmudge's Corner. Yes, this is a break. Yes, this is a break. Break, 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 break. Yes, 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 this is a break. Yes, this is a break. Break, 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 break. Yes, it is a break. And now, and now, and now, and now the break is over.
And here I am. And so I'm going to do the Google Reader thing. So I'm hitting refresh in Google Reader right now. Get the latest articles, get the whatever. And we'll see what we have. And I'll go down these articles. I'll actually list them so you get a sense of what my Google feed looks like. We got Fear and Conservatism by Josh Marshall. And the one-line summary, or the first intro, according to a new study co-authored by Brown University political scientist Rose McDermott, a fearful people are likely to have conservative attitudes to so-called out-groups, and that heavily affects attitudes on hot-button issues like immigration, war, segregation, racial, and sexual difference. And then there's a press release. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about this one. I do find it interesting that there have been a bunch of studies sort of correlating sort of very innate things to people's political attitudes, where, you know, yeah, you think there's a lot of it's going to be your upbringing and who and your parents and how they raised you and the political views you were espoused to, and those do have a very significant effect. But apparently there's also a significant sort of innate how your brain is wired sort of thing, and there's, you know, there's some possibility that there's at least some genetic component towards your political predisposition. And also that there potentially is sort of a chemical component, that you could potentially give people drugs that would change their political orientation and viewpoint. I find that stuff fascinating, but I don't know enough about it. I'm not going to talk about it. Okay, next article. Facing down a copyright troll in federal appeals court from the EFF. You know, copyright's one of my hobby horses. I talk about it a lot. I don't feel like it right now. Monopoly piece contest. Kitty in, iron out from Boing Boing, Mark Frohenfelder. They got rid of the iron. They're inserting a cat. I don't care. Stop the Great Coal Export Conspiracy, Greenpeace. Something about Greenpeace. I don't care. A Facebook request to add me to some birthday app. Okay, I get these on a regular basis, and I will say they are annoying. I never say yes. My birthday is in Facebook already. You know, I haven't added any sort of app, whatever, and I always get these notifications that people's birthdays are coming up. Isn't that good enough for you guys? You need some special birthday app? I mean, these things have got to be scams, right? Is there any real legitimate reason for these? If anybody out there knows, let me know. What's going on with Hegel? Andrew Sullivan. Andrew Sullivan's one of my favorites to you know, and basically we're talking about, I guess, Hegel's nomination hearing didn't go all that well, but he's still expected to pass. But there are some people that are demanding extra information and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I'm having trouble caring so far. I mean, from everything I've read so far, it still looks like the nomination's going to go through. It's not going to die and commit in the Senate. And it's just a question of if there are a few more hoops to jump through. If that changes, then maybe I'll care. From everything I've read about the guy, sounds like he'll make a fine Secretary of Defense. That's it. That's all I got. Okay. TechCrunch, something about Twitter TV ratings. Don't care. My own daily tweet summary. Don't care. You know, another thing from Engadget about fixing stuff, the two things they mention, the first thing they mention is software that doesn't auto-save. Agreed completely. Yes. All software at this point should have some sort of auto-saving functionality and some sort of versioning functionality. That's it. That's all I got. And then they've got some bitch about cables and different cables. I don't care as much about that one. Something about a new game with cyber hoops. Don't care. you know, I should just jump and do something. There's new Iran sanctions in the New York Times, something about whaling in the New York Times, something about models in the New York Times, don't care. Here's one I might spend a few minutes talking about. Panetta warns of dire consequences to military from cuts. This is from the New York Times by Elizabeth Boomiller. In the wake of President Obama's appeal to Congress to stave off across-the-board military and domestic spending cuts, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta warned Wednesday that reductions from the automatic cuts would curtail American naval operations in the Western Pacific by as much as a third and force one-month furloughs for as many as 800,000 Defense Department civilian employees starting this spring. This is not a game. This is reality, Mr. Panetta said emphatically at a speech at Georgetown University. Adding, this is not a way to govern the United States of America. These steps would damage the American economy and they would degrade our ability to respond to crisis, blah, 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 blah. And it goes on. The one thing I want to say about this is, okay, I buy the economic impact. You suddenly lay off 800,000 people. Of course, it's going to have an impact. You suddenly reduce spending. Of course, it's going to have an impact. There's a very, very good argument that dropping suddenly off a cliff with a sequester is not the best way to go about reducing spending, that it's much better for the overall economy and health of the country, et cetera, to do these things slowly. But there's also this argument about the effects on our readiness and our defense and our whatever. Bottom line here, our defense budget, our military budget is so much bigger than anybody else in the world. What is the real threat here? And I think we're drastically overextended. Like, what is the threat? The threat is that we could no longer be able to, you know, fight two major conflicts in different parts of the world and react instantly to anything that happens anywhere in the world. I would argue we don't have to. I'm not an isolationist. I think the U.S. should be involved in the world and in foreign affairs and whatever, but I don't think we need the kind of military we have in order to defend ourselves. We only need the kind of military we have to sort of insert ourselves into all kinds of parts of the world where really we probably don't really need to, and doing so is probably counterproductive. And I think we would be just fine with a significantly reduced defense budget that really was concentrated on, you know, I guess almost what the Department of Homeland Security is supposed to do, defending the homeland. Now, we're not expecting invasions from Mexico or Canada or anything like that, but perhaps there are some threats that would, you know, impinge directly on the U.S. That we could be thinking about what are the right ways to defend against. And, you know, certainly there are long-term threats from certain parts of the world, but, you know, not immediate threats, and we could do with a lot less. You know, we don't have to do everything we're doing right now. And even the Defense Department themselves have argued that some cuts are fine, that they've got more money than they really need. A lot of this really is about entrenched interests who want to make sure that money keeps getting spent. Going back to Eisenhower's good old military-industrial complex, it feeds itself. You know, I think it's actually very, very telling that, you know, the first thing in what Panetta said, these steps would seriously damage the fragile American economy. He says that first, before he says it would degrade our ability to respond to crisis in a time of rising instability across the globe. I think that's very telling. The primary interest here is the economic interest, not the defense interest. That's not saying there isn't a real defense interest, but I think on the defense side, you know, there are a lot of things going around in the world that, you know, there might be instability across the globe, but most of that instability doesn't necessarily need to impact us unless we insert ourselves. Anyway, that's enough rambling for the moment. I guess we got one sort of thing I actually talked about for real, maybe two out of that segment. We're going to take another break. I'm going for 10-minute segments this time around. We're going to take another break. And when we come back, rather than flipping through these articles, like the very next one I have is Chris Christie too fat to be president? And that's from Mark and Binder. Rather than flipping through the articles and reading you the names, I'm going to, during the break, pick one and come back and talk about it. So we'll be back after this. This is Sam here with an opportunity for you. Yes, you heard me right, an opportunity. For you loyal listeners of Curmudgeon's Corner, you know, every once in a while, Yvonne can't make a show. And I do a solo show, which, you know, I think I do okay. But, you know, it's always interesting to have a second person to bounce off. And just in general, sometimes it's good to hear another voice. If you, yes, you, have some things to say about the kinds of things we usually talk about on Curmudgeon's Corner, you know, politics, current events, news, tech, then drop me a line at abelsmay@abelsmay.com letting me know. And hey, I'll keep you in mind and maybe ask if you can join us sometime, either on a regular show with Yvonne if it's something particularly pressing that you maybe have an expertise on, or just, you know, hey, an opportunity to co-host when Yvonne is out. Who knows? Now, I am not guaranteeing that if you send me an email, you'll definitely get on the show, but let me know if you're interested and I'll keep you in mind. Thanks, and now back to the show. Yes, Alex?
Daddy.
Yeah. I'll be down to play with trains again in a little bit. I'm about halfway through what I'm doing.
I found a steam engine.
With the steam engine?
Yeah. Play a steam engine.
You want me to play a steam engine?
Yeah. His name is Hank.
His name is Hank.
Hank, I'm not coming in the back of Zodor. And Thomas have a plow. And not pulling cars.
Okay, I'll be down in a while. And that was Alex. So I actually hadn't finished getting my topic yet, but he came in and so I hit record. We'll be back in just another second. Okay, here we go. So back for real this time. And the topic of choice is the post office. The United States Postal Service, specifically. They announced on Wednesday, I guess, that it's going to stop delivering mails on Saturday to save money. And there are a few interesting things about this. One is the whole economics of the post office, but another thing is they're Congress regulates the post office very heavily. Apparently, the federal government no longer funds the post office, but it's still a quasi-public entity, and so its structure and how it runs and everything is still governed by laws, and the laws actually say they have to deliver on Saturday. Congress has several times passed laws that say the post office has to continue delivering mail on Saturday. The post office is announcing that they're not going to. And so one argument is that they're actually trying desperately to get Congress's attention. Felix Salmon is one person who argued about that. But basically saying, you know, they're in financial straits, and they're financial straits because, again, of laws specifying what they have to do. For instance, there is a congressional act passed in 2006 that makes the United States Postal Service pre-fund 75 years worth of pensions. 75 years is a long time. That's a lot of money. And there's been apparently some analysis, and this is Anne Rose Strasser, an article by her pointed this out, that without that pension requirement, the post office would actually have a very significant surplus. But, you know, the laws are in place and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, look, I have this thing. I understand the need for some sort of public mail system. I mean, the whole notion is that you need to have the ability to deliver mail to absolutely every resident in the country. Because if it was just completely up to a private industry, there would be locations that just weren't served. The more rural, less profitable locations. Having said that, I think the coverage zones for UPS and FedEx are pretty darn extensive, and things would probably be figured out. You know, if the post office ceased to exist tomorrow and the monopoly on first-class mail was taken away, you know, it would be figured out. I mean, I don't think you'd have a lot of places that didn't have any coverage whatsoever, because all of these companies would pride themselves on having essentially a universal reach. And if they didn't, the number of people affected would be very, very small. Now, you can argue that you don't want that number to be anything other than zero, but come on, really? The other thing I'd say is anything that sort of speeds the obsolescence of the post office and first-class mail, and don't even get me talking about third-class email, third-class mail, although I probably will in a second. I think the better. I mean, I consider, look, here's a fundamental thing on how things work, at least where I live. This may or may not be similar where you guys are. The post office, as again, as part of cost cutting, as part of whatever, has increasingly been moving away from individual mailboxes per residence. And by that, I don't mean you don't get a box that's just you. I mean putting one on your house or right next to your house. Now, I understand if you're in a big apartment building, okay, you have the big thing with the mail for everybody near the front door or whatever. Okay, fine, whatever. But even in residential neighborhoods of single-family homes, the trend has been more and more towards you have like one mailbox per block, one big thing, just like you have in apartment complexes. In my own personal situation here, we have to walk. It's not like miles or anything. I mean, realistically, but we have to walk like half a block to go get our mail. And it's a pain in the ass. You know, I generally I'll do it sometimes when I'm walking the dog, but it's a pain in the ass to go walk to the mailbox and then come back with a handful of stuff. And it's annoying. And it's even more annoying because there's very, very little that actually comes by postal mail that I want to come by postal mail. Personal letters, almost all replaced by email. You know, you get the occasional holiday card or holiday letter or something like that, or somebody intentionally trying to be old-fashioned. But for the most part, you don't get personal mail anymore. Bills and statements, all of that's electronic most of the time now. There are very few that still need to be paper. Magazines, really? Come on. Magazines are dying. Those should all be online too. You know, same with newspapers, etc. You know, most of the time when I go to the damn mailbox, almost all of it is junk mail I don't want. As it is, I rarely go to the mailbox. I mean, like, theoretically, you should check it every day, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Realistically, we check our mail maybe once a week. Sometimes it may go 2 or 3 weeks without us even bothering checking the mailbox. And then we go, and the thing is stuffed full of crap. Crap that we don't want. Now, there is occasionally something real in there that comes from some backwards organization that doesn't know how to do electronic communication. And that's annoying too, because it's like, really? You sent me this by mail? It's like the default at this point is to toss the stuff that comes by mail because it's worthless. And you know, so it really annoys me when some organization sends you something by physical mail instead of doing things electronically. And like, you know, I mentioned bills and stuff. Of course, checks the same way. I mean, direct deposit anybody? You know, really? You're going to mail me a check? And you know, okay, and even like personal, you know, if somebody owes me money or something, yeah, don't mail me a check at this point. You know, send me the money through some electronic means. There are dozens of them out there. You know, you can PayPal me, there's Google Payments, there's a bunch. And my employer does one too. Really, come on. And then with packages, like, you know, if a package comes with UPS or FedEx or whatever, they leave it on my doorstep right there. If it gets sent through the post office, they try to stick it in my mailbox that's half a block away, gets a key, and I use that key to open a bigger box and the same thing, and there's my package. And it's half a block away. The only time they don't do that is if that little box is full, and then they'll bring it to the door. But you can tell they're like, I wish I didn't have to bring this to the door. I want to put it in the box with everything else, or I guess if it's too big or whatever. But anyway, I find postal mail annoying, except for packages. Packages, I understand. Packages, I understand. And you know, and I can see some need for some first-class type mail. Okay, fine. Some documents aren't electronic yet, and you have to send them, blah, blah, blah. Okay, I see some need. But really, the U.S. Postal Service is the least satisfying experience of any of the folks who deliver stuff to me. And maybe, you know, they are hamstrung by all these regulations and requirements for pensions and blah, blah, blah. And if you got rid of that, they could do something decent. I generally think I'm fine with privatizing the USPS. I'm absolutely fine with that. Get the government out of their regulation, out of that regulation. Let them do what they please. You know, if they have obligations that they're currently under, whatever, privatize them. And then, you know, if there really is truly a need for universal first-class service or whatever, first of all, most first-class service, I'd let, say, you know, let whatever companies do whatever they want. You know, if kill the monopoly, let UPS and FedEx and the like decide if they want to get into that business. But then if there are still gaps, then set up a federal contract for providing service to those last bits that aren't going to be covered by, yeah, the private companies, and put it up for bid, and somebody will serve it. It'll cost more than regular postal service, and the federal government can subsidize it if they feel like it. But, you know, cover the gap that way, but let most of it go. And I'm hoping, as part of that shakeout, third-class mail just disappears. You know, it's got to be getting less profitable by the day. Does anybody really still look at that crap? But, you know, hopefully third-class mail just goes away. You know, yeah, if you really want to send something to somebody, send full price, whatever. But, you know, this mass mail crap has got to go. It's horrible in the electronic world. It's horrible in the physical world. Just stop. Anyway, that's my thoughts on the post office, and I've gone over my 10 minutes, so we'll take another break, and we'll talk about one more subject, which, once again, I will determine during the break.
You're in the Valley, AM 1620, and LiganAirRadio.com. This is where you'll find your favorite songs. Classic music for a classic American town, AM 1620, and in stereo at LigonierRadio.com. The Valley.
Okay, we're back. And before I get to the next subject, I just want to say that that spot we just had was for The Valley, which is a radio station partially run by an old friend of mine, Ron. I don't know if he still listens to the show, but he did at one point. But I will say, if you want to stream that on the internet, you can certainly go to their website. But if you use an app like I use TuneIn Pro on my iPhone, it's actually kind of a pain to get it on there. You have to put in a custom URL and stuff. If anybody needs help with that, toss me an email at ablesmay@ablesmay.com. I'll guide you through that. As for the topic for this last segment, I guess I can't avoid it. It's going to be the 16-page white paper that was leaked to Michael Isikoff of NBC from the Department of Justice. Lawfulness of a lethal operation directed against a U.S. citizen who is a senior operational leader of Al-Qaeda or an associated force. There's been some commentary on this. Is James Joyner at the National Interest Killing Americans. There are a bunch of others, though, and I'll be honest and say I haven't gone as deep into that as I should have or could have before really talking about it here. And I'm going to sound somewhat like a broken record for the times I've talked about this kind of thing before. But look, the high-level summary of this thing is that it tries to... So here's a summary again from that James Joyner. The first paragraph of the white paper notes, this paper does not attempt to determine the minimum requirements necessary to render such an operation lawful, nor does it assess what might be required to render a lethal operation against a U.S. citizen lawful in other circumstances. But it goes into 16 pages worth of the circumstances in which the U.S. government could use lethal force in a foreign country outside the area of active hostilities against a U.S. citizen who's a senior operational leader of Al-Qaeda or associated force. And then it concludes three conditions must be met. Number one, an informed high-level official of the U.S. government has determined that the targeted individual poses an imminent threat of violent attack against the United States. Number two, capture is infeasible and the United States continues to monitor whether capture becomes feasible. And three, the operation would be conducted in a manner consistent with applicable law of war principles. But then the rest of the thing goes through all kinds of lengths to redefine those conditions in a really, really broad ways to make them essentially meaningless. Like, for instance, they talk about imminent threat, but say imminent threat shouldn't be construed as having direct evidence that this individual is actually going to do an attack in the near future and has the capability of doing so, or something like that. So it could be anything. And basically, you end up with this whole thing. You know, and they mentioned that U.S. citizens may have due process rights, and you know, the right not to be attacked must be balanced against the United States' interest in forestalling future violence and death, etc. You know, and so there's lots of wiggle room and blah blah blah. Basically, it's all when you read the whole thing, it all comes back down to the executive branch of the government can decide they want to kill somebody and do it, including U.S. citizens. This is all specifically about U.S. citizens. Of course, they certainly do this for non-citizens without thinking twice about it as well. And what's troubling about this, and again, I've railed about this, is all of this coming down to very, very small groups of people being able to make these decisions without any oversight, without any checks and balances whatsoever. And the one thing, like, of everything, you know, the U.S. Constitution has a bunch of things it did right, it has a bunch of things it did wrong. The one thing that I think it did exceptionally right that over the last 200 plus years has been breaking down more and more is the notion of checks and balances and separation of powers and trying to construct a system where essentially no one person had sole power to do almost anything. You know, the old notion was we don't want a king. We don't want a system where you have people who are able to make decisions without being accountable for those decisions. And in with this kind of stuff, we're setting up a process that's secret. Like, because one idea is, okay, well, even if the president has, you know, huge amounts of power, hey, there's an election every 4 years. We can always throw them out if they're abusing it. Well, if all this stuff is secret, you don't know what they're abusing and what they're not abusing and whether you would agree with it if you knew about it. So that sort of takes even that out of the equation. You know, and I sort of have as a fundamental principle that especially on these like really important matters of life and death, this stuff has to be, should be conducted in the sunshine. You know, if you really think it's, if it is a critical issue for the U.S. to, you know, be at war somewhere, fine. Go through the process. Have a congressional declaration of war. Have the debate. Have the discussion. Have it all out there and then do that. And if we're going to kill people through drone strikes or whatever, and it's really necessary, okay, you should be able to make that case. And of course, you know, it's been pointed out, you know, you can't like decide, you get intelligence that Joe Bob terrorist is in a certain spot in a certain time, you know, you can't go and have a public debate about it before you go kill him because by the time you do that, he's gone. Okay, fine, I buy that. But at the very least, you know, all this stuff should be public afterwards. And you should be able to talk about it. And Mark Binder made some of this point after the fact, even if there's some delay. But I would say a lot of this you should be able to say in advance, and not necessarily on specific people, but you should be able to define very clearly what your criteria is. You should have a process in place that makes sure it's not single, you know, that it's not only the executive branch. Like, require... You know, Congress should pass a law defining the process that's used here, and that process should involve, you know, somebody from the judiciary branch signing off on many of these cases. And you know, we have a process like that for FISA. I think even that process is way too secretive and way too deferential to the executive, but at least we have something. You don't have that here. You know, and the problem, and again, like, I don't necessarily want to argue whether or not in some of the cases where they've made these strikes, they were absolutely right or wrong or whatever. I think there's certainly a lot of evidence that they have made a lot of mistakes and they have killed a lot of innocent people. But that's not the problem to me. The problem is, to me, is the process that's involved in the decision making, and the fact that there's no oversight and there's no checks and balances and there's no, you know, that basically the president or members of his staff can make a decision that says, this guy's bad, we're going to kill him, and just do it. Without having any sort of formal process in place to put checks and balances in that, to review the evidence, to make sure that it's good, to make sure that there's a true compelling need to do so. Like, you know, if we really were in a situation where, okay, the point number one of the paper, the individual poses an imminent threat of violent attack. Okay, if we're really talking an imminent threat, the guy is, you know, in the process of hijacking the plane to do another 9/11. Okay. But we're talking about people who are, you know, off in Yemen or somewhere, and they may be plotting something, but there may or may not be any evidence that they really can do anything about it. And, it's very, very weak conditions, at least that have been made public. And, you know, there may be a lot more that's secret, but that's part of the problem. And of course, the argument is, you know, hey, these drone strikes are very, very targeted. Even if they get a few innocents in the process, it's much less than, like, if you really were in an outright war and carpet bombing and all of this kind of stuff. Okay. But that, I don't think that's the right comparison. The right comparison really is do nothing. And in some of these cases, the right answer is do nothing. Or the right answer is capture these people and put them on trial if there really is something that they have already done that's breaking some sort of international law that, you know, or domestic law if they were here. But, you know, and Yvonne and I have talked about this before. You know, there was a lot of criticism for President Bush for people he'd captured and thrown in Guantanamo and indefinite detention and how we were treating these prisoners and whether we were torturing them and, you know, whether they'd ever go to trial and how they could defend themselves, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Obama seems to have decided that the right way to deal with this is, okay, capturing them is a pain in the ass. Let's just kill them. I don't think that's a move in the right direction. It's just not. I mean, and it, maybe it's cleaner in some way and you don't get all this heartache and you don't have to address all of these issues of how to treat the prisoners and what to do with the prisoners and all of this kind of stuff. But really, our answer is capturing people and putting them on trial and providing due process and giving them a chance to defend themselves is too much of a pain in the ass, so we'll just kill them? I have no doubt that some of these people truly pose threats. I think in many cases that threat has probably been overblown and taken way out of proportion to the real level of threat. I mean, even 9/11 wasn't an existential threat to this country. It was horrible, but it wasn't an existential threat to the country. And we amazingly overreacted to that in so many ways. But you know, it's just kind of, and you got to remember also, when it comes to executive power, there's a ratchet effect. Any powers that are granted almost never go away again. And you're basically setting precedent here of what it's okay to do. And they've, you know, and they've actually declined to say that they can't apply some of this within the United States. So it's you know, now that hasn't been happening so far, but they've specifically not ruled that out either. You know, there are very severe restrictions on when police can use lethal force. And when there really is an imminent danger situation, they certainly can. This kind of thing should apply in these cases too. I mean, there should be a very, very high threshold for when we take a violent solution to things. And again, I've even talked here about the comparison of, you know, World War II. We killed people indiscriminately. Civilians. You know, there were, of course, there was Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There's also the firebombing of Dresden and many other cities. And that's just part of how war works, or at least worked. But, you know, the world is growing up. The level of violence that happened during World War II is almost unimaginable today. mean, I of course can imagine situations where we would get into that situation again, but it'd be such a tragedy. It'd be so horrible. It's not where we want to go. And I'm not saying this is that even, but our standards have changed, is my point. Things that would have been acceptable 20, 30 years ago are no longer acceptable now. At least they shouldn't be. And it makes me so sad that they often actually are. But again, getting back to the crux of it to me, like, even if you are making these decisions in some situations, and even if it's completely justifiable, the problem is the process. The problem is not that we do drone strikes. That's not the problem. Drone strikes are probably, not probably, drone strikes are going to be a very useful tool. And in some cases, they will be very necessary. And they will be much better than some other alternatives. The problem is not drone strikes. The problem isn't even killing U.S. citizens who might be a threat to us. The problem is the process. The problem is that the process that is being set up is one that is being set up in such a way that it can be very easily abused. And okay, maybe people will say, you know, but I trust Obama. I trust the Obama administration. They'll make the right calls. You should never, ever, ever set up a process that, to work properly, relies on your trust of the individuals that are doing that process. That's the whole point of process. You put in the constraints. The constraints aren't in place to protect you from the guy you agree with on everything. The constraints are in place to protect you from the people that you disagree with getting in power at some point in the future. They're in place to protect you from some crazy dude coming in the future and taking the reins of power. They're, you know, it's, and what, I'm dumbfounded that, with a few exceptions, of course, but most of the people who are out there every day talking about how awful George W. Bush was in terms of the indefinite detentions in Guantanamo and treating prisoners and blah, 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 these same people aren't saying a damn thing about what Obama's doing. And I would argue in many cases what Obama's doing is worse. At least if you get thrown in Guantanamo, there's some chance of you getting out at some point. If you get thrown into Guantanamo unjustly, let me say, it turns out the government was wrong and you weren't really a terrorist. You were incidentally in the wrong place at the wrong time. At least there's a chance that at some point somebody will realize that. You'll go through some sort of process and they'll say, I'm sorry, and let you go. It's actually happened many times at this point. Lots of people have actually been sent away from Guantanamo and repatriated to wherever. You can't do that if they've killed you. So we should have higher standards for that, not lower standards. It's insanely frustrating. And it shows the double standards of the people who are criticizing W for that, but then shut the hell up as soon as there was a Democrat in the White House. Really? Come on. Be consistent here, please. And you know, it just exposes how much of that was really just about Republican versus Democrat and, you know, our side's good, the other side's bad, as opposed to really being about the fundamental principles underlying things. You know, if you need the president to follow due process, that should be true whether the president is some guy you like or some guy you don't like. Frustrates the hell out of me. And I applaud the people out there who actually have been consistent on these kinds of issues and have called out Obama just as much as they've called out W. I hope to put myself in that category. You know, And I ended up not voting for Obama in this last election in 2012. I voted for the Libertarian primarily because of this kind of stuff. You know, I think Obama was a better choice than McCain and a better choice than Romney. But I think this kind of thing should be disqualifying. We need presidents who actually believe in the limits of presidential power and that there should be checks and balances and that they shouldn't have free reign to do whatever the hell they want. But as I've said many times, it's all well and good when you're not president to say checks on presidential power are good. And Obama even said that in some cases. But once you're president, all of a sudden it's restrictions on you. And of course you know the right thing to do. It's you. You're smart. You're wise. You're good at these things. And you'll make the right decision. But you won't always be president. And you shouldn't be setting up precedents that give carte blanche power to whoever holds that office. It's just too much power to be concentrated in one place. My one unifying concept politically is not individual freedom. It's not anything economic. It's that concentration of power is bad. And that power should be spread out as much as is practical. I'm not a complete anarchist. I think there's a role of government. I think there's a significant role of government. There are lots of things where I think government really needs to be involved. But I think at every step in the process, you need to be thinking about how decision-making can be diluted. And yes, that makes it less efficient. But that's the point. That's the fucking point. When you're talking about deciding who to kill, you do not want efficiency. You want that process to be slow. You want that process to be deliberate. You want that process to have checks and balances, etc. Okay. Any more and I'll just be repeating myself over and over and over again like I probably already have. We're getting close to the hour, and look, I managed to do a whole hour by myself again, or almost. I apologize for the rambling at the beginning. You know, okay, nobody cared about what I'm drinking and what I'm eating. Sorry. You know, you get some of that on this show. And I'm, you know, whatever. If you tune into our show, you know what you get. And you know, the second section, okay, a little bit rambling, but at least you got a test of my RSS feed. Yeah, what's at the top of my list right now? Let's see. Google Maps with Street View arrives on Nintendo Wii. Chrome for Android may have a dev channel for avant-garde web viewers. Rebel Alliance demands scalp from Darth Rove. Okay, that sounds interesting. Something about Doctor Who, something about Las Vegas. Who cares? Show's over. Follow my Twitter feed if you want to see the articles I read. Yeah, I basically post the things that I get all the way through and think are interesting. Which reminds me of another feedback thing I got, but oh well, it was over Twitter. Who cares? We'll do it some other time. Somebody pointed out that they think that the stuff I read is too liberally oriented and I need more conservative stuff in the mix. I tweeted back to them through a private message because that's how they'd contacted me. Give me suggestions. I'm wide open. I add conservative sources to my feed all the time, and I like to listen to them to a degree. A lot of them I end up dumping if I end up thinking they're stupid. But, you know, but I'm willing to give anybody a shot. So if you have any suggestions of people, magazine, whatever, things I should be reading online, especially if they have RSS feeds. If they don't have an RSS feed, screw it. give me the suggestion. I'd be happy to take a look and add that to my mix. Anyway, I vamped for a little bit there just so we could get to an hour. We're hitting an hour in the next 3 seconds. So thanks, everybody, for listening. As usual, email me at abelsmay@abelsmay.com. There we go. We just went past an hour. Tell all your friends to listen. If you have questions, comments, send them my way. In the meantime, have a good week, and we'll talk to you next time. Goodbye.